Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Dina Ibrahim, Associate Professor of Broadcast and Electronic Communication Arts at San Francisco State University. I'll be the moderator for today's program called Women Seeking Success and Reform. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panelists. Starting from the end, we have Judith Hornook. She is author of The Modern Arab Woman. Judith lives in Vienna and is the founder of Hornock and Partner, a firm which advises companies about the business culture in the Arab Gulf. Leila El-Sisi is an educator and author of Out of the Shadows of Men. We'll have a book signing after the event. Leila is originally from Egypt. And Aisha Wahab, who is a human and political rights activist and board member of the Afghan Coalition. Aisha was invited to the White House and as part of the Afghan American Leaders Roundtable and was part of a peace delegation to Afghanistan. Now we will begin with comments from Aisha.
Hi there. I just want to say it's a pleasure to be here, and I will be primarily talking with a couple of examples from Afghanistan and my trip to Afghanistan, but overall a general overview of women seeking reforms and how it is in the Middle East. Primarily, one of the things that happens when you think of women in the Middle East is you think of this, a woman in a burqa, women that are oppressed, things like that. The sad truth of the matter is that you also have to take into consideration the two different ways of thinking. There are people who believe culture and religion is one thing, but then also we have to take into consideration that when we talk about women, it's two sides to the story. We see women throughout the world as being oppressed or an object for men. You either see a woman who's fully covered and we think, wow, she's oppressed. I don't know why she does what she does. How can someone live with a veil across her face for the rest of her life? And yet, at the same time, the other side of the world views the way we see things in women with bikinis as oppressed and an object for men. So there's two sides to the story, and I think that that's one of the biggest things that people can actually take into consideration. We don't ever hear about the magnificent women from that side of the world. For example, this individual is named Roya Mahboob. She is a 27-year-old entrepreneur from Afghanistan. She has created over 20-plus classes throughout Afghanistan to train young women how to program and code. And also, she's working on a project that will create superheroes for young children to identify with and have. For example, we have Spider-Man, Wolverine, Superman, and she's creating that for other young women in other parts of the world. We also don't hear about Queen Rania of Jordan, who consistently pushes women's rights and education in her country. So there's many different heroes that we can see in those parts of the world that push for reform, and slowly and surely they are gaining a following. One of the things that I do want to explain is that culture is different from religion, and brutality against women is not a religious thing. It's not a cultural thing. Brutality against women is an ideology that is shared amongst every single country in the world, regardless of whether it's a Western first world country or if it's a developing nation. Some examples I can give you is female genital mutilation. It's not a religious thing. It's not part of Islam. It's not part of any real religion for the most part. It's just some people practice that. For example, another example would be racism and ethnic tensions. It's not a religious thing. It's a cultural thing. Some people view themselves as better than others, and that is not a religious thing, especially not in Islam. So the other thing that I can actually mention is that when we compare our standards, our first world modern standards, to countries that have had war for over 40 years, like Afghanistan. Afghanistan has had no peace in 40 years, whereas we in America have had relative peace throughout our country for over 200 years, for the most part. I do want to say that without peace, there is no opportunity for progression. And that's something to take into consideration when we put our standards on these developing nations, these nations in ruins, and these nations with no actual infrastructure or rule of law. Some of the things that I just want to go over is that majority of the Middle Eastern countries is a patriarchy. The other thing is that Islam is one of the most dominant religions in that region, but it's not the only religion. You have Christianity, you have Judaism, you have Druze, you have a lot of different beliefs in that small little region. But Islam is over 1,000 years old, and it's the second largest religion in the world. The other thing is that families are different. We in America have a nucleus family, the mother, father, and roughly about 2.5 kids. Over there, there's extended families. People who get involved in your life, your day-to-day life, is your aunts, your grandparents, your second cousins, your first cousins, your, you know, neighbor. It's a completely different structure of life and family. And one of the things that I do want to explain is that the Middle East is parts of North Africa and Arab nations. It does not include Persia, which is Iran and Afghanistan. They're different languages, different cultures, different beliefs, different way of eating. It's completely different. But we often hear Middle East, and we put in together Afghanistan and Iran and a lot of other countries. And the only thing that they share is Islam. That's it. And it's not even the exact same version of Islam. So I do want to say that overall, in my experience, I have seen women around the world do not have equal rights. Doesn't matter where you're from. For example, some of these basic restrictions that women in the Middle East face that I can explain to you is, one, the lack of mobility. In Saudi Arabia, it's illegal for women to drive. Freedom of marriage. According to the United Nations, 40% of women in South Asia and Africa are married by the time they are 18 or at least engaged. And when you hear about honor killings or arranged marriages, it's, yes, in Islam you have the right to say, no, I do not want to get married. You have the right as a woman to say, I want a divorce. But it's completely different. You have a lot of pressure to just go with the family, go with the pressure of society, and that causes a lot of problems. Some of the other things in regards to marriage that's uncommon here is child brides. They're very common, and sadly, the child bride is often sold as a slave almost, to pay off the debt of the family. They hold a very low status in the husband's family. And majority of them have a lot of health risks. When they're that young, 12, 13, 14 years old, childbirth is a very difficult thing. Oftentimes, a lot of women die. They have a lot of PTSD. They have a lot of different health problems that often goes unheard or untreated. And I do want to say, for example, in Afghanistan, the average age of a widow is 35 years old because her husband is often significantly older than her. Women also have unfair divorce rights. For example, a man can say divorce, 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 and he's divorced. He just has to say it 3 times. Whereas a woman, she's unable to do that. And at the same time, for example, in Lebanon, a woman who is abused can only seek a divorce if there's someone willing to testify on her behalf that she's been abused. And that doesn't happen commonly. Citizenship. Many Middle Eastern countries, women do not have a right to pass on citizenship to their children, while men do. They can also pass it on to their other wives. Custody rights, sadly, usually we hear that custody is more in favor of the woman in the United States. However, in the Middle East, it's not. The belief is that how can I have a woman who may potentially get married have another man raise my children? So she usually is not given rights to her own children. She's often also discarded very quickly. Violence and rape. Spousal rape is non-existent in India. There is a law that basically says we do not identify spousal rape as rape amongst married people. And a former spouse who is raped, its law is less harsher than if a woman was raped that was not an individual man's former spouse. So you could potentially rape your ex-wife with very little consequences, and that's legally observed. Workforce. One thing about the workforce is that there's not a lot of women that contribute to it, and that is due to the lack of education and also the lack of support, financial support, family support, and things like that. Some of the other things that I can discuss is inheritance. The shocking, sad truth is that if you have three kids, one's a boy and two are girls, and land is very important because that's how people farm, that's how people make money. When your parents pass, 50% will go to the son, and the other 50 is divided equally between the daughters. So each get 25, while the boy gets more. Access to education. We all hear the stories of schools being bombed. We all know Malala of Pakistan being shot. We all understand that women just getting a basic education, it's almost a life or death situation. Do you plan on going to school and possibly getting acid thrown in your face? Do you plan on going to school and possibly getting kidnapped, stoned, beaten, raped, anything like that? All of that is very much possible for our 5-year-old girls, 6-year-old girls, 12-year-old girls, 14-year-old girls. It's shocking. And overall, the security for women is non-existent. Like I said, they get harassed on a daily basis. My personal experience in Afghanistan was pretty shocking. I can actually say that some of the things that was interesting or unusual for people to see was that a woman playing with a dog. I was told many, many times this is like never happened. So I saw that. I drank a Red Bull. They said, we've never seen a woman drink a Red Bull. I was shocked. I didn't know that was a gender thing there. Another thing is that I actually met an individual, a female. Maryam Kufi is a member of parliament in Afghanistan. One of the shocking facts is that there are more elected officials that are women in Afghanistan than there are in the United States. And that's shocking. And some of the things that I learned was that the mentality of the youth, which is the dominant and majority of the population in Afghanistan, who are 28 and younger, they're very open-minded. Both the men and the women are very open-minded compared to the elders. The only difference is that when I ask them, do you guys date? They do, but their version of dating is very different. I asked, what does that consist of? Some of these guys told me that if they sit at a table with, let's say, 5 ladies after class, they consider themselves dating each one of those 5 women, and that's a date. And I was like, wow, that's completely different than what we have here. And we also, I do just want to mention that we hear about media bias, but one of the things that was interesting is that this picture depicts over 20 different journalists and studios that attended a press conference that we were at. None of them were women. When I asked some of the female journalists why didn't they attend or what happened, they said that they were completely excluded from attending this event and they were not allowed to actually attend. This was extremely disheartening. I was really shaken up, but we changed that in the next press conference. We often hear that women in Afghanistan are liberated after the U.S. Presence. The fact of the matter is there are no women in the streets. And men, when I told men this, they clearly said, oh, I never even noticed, right? So in this entire busy bazaar, there are no women except for these two who are gawked at. And they're fully covered, they're fully dressed, and they have to deal with either being gawked at, touched, pinched, harassed, catcalled, you name it, they have to deal with it. So women are not liberated in Afghanistan, and this is Kabul, the capital. This one of the only things that I do want to mention is this individual, Dr. Soraya Sobrong, is a women's rights activist, and she comes from London. She's working on women's rights groups, and some of the things that she said, it was very interesting. She used the term positive discrimination, and I never understood what the term was, so I asked her, what is that? Like, why are you working on positive discrimination? After she explained that, I understood what she meant was our version of affirmative action. They just use a different term. And positive discrimination basically means that they want women at a certain percentage to attend schools, to attend businesses, to be a part of the club. And I do want to say that all the meetings that I attended were male-dominated. There were no women sitting at the table, and I had to fight for my seat amongst these men. And as you see, I'm not wearing a chadar or a head covering, and nobody said anything because I do believe it's our right to fight for our seat at the table. And this is my last slide, second to last slide. I do want to say that I met with a lot of women who were like-minded. They wanted to fight for women's rights. They wanted to specifically be involved and have their voices heard, and they're working on that. Sadly, in March, a woman was stoned to death because she was falsely accused of burning the Quran. She was stoned, beaten, gasoline thrown on her, lit on fire, a car ran over her, and her dead body was thrown into a river. Out of all the men, an entire mob of over 60, 70 people from the videos that we watched attacked her. Not one person stood up for her. And the justice that was served in a two-day trial was that 11 men served a sentence of 1 year and only 4 men be hanged. And that's not justice. And one of the things that I took out of that is that if there is no justice, there is no hope. And rule of law needs to be observed. And at the same time, women are fighting for this. This particular picture depicts that woman, Farhunda. Her dead body that was being carried to her grave is traditionally done by men. Women were so fed up that they said, no, we are going to carry the body to her grave. And what happened is men said, this is not your job. They said, I'm so sorry, but we don't see any men at all to do this. So they buried her, and this was completely one of the most amazing things in the world. I personally thought that this was the rebirth of hope. And even though Farhunda died the way she did, her brutal death, it literally sparked a revolution that is continuing today. And I'm very proud to say that I do hope that this is a step forward to progress.
Thank you. That was Aisha Wahab, a human and political rights activist, a part of the Afghan American Leaders Roundtable and a peace delegation to Afghanistan. Next, we'll hear from Leila El Sisi.
Hi, everybody. This is Leila. I am Egyptian. I was born in Alexandria, Egypt. And I moved here to the United States in 1982. And I never, ever thought of writing my story, but what happened in the Middle East with the Arab Spring enticed me to write my story so I can help all the young women and girls in the Middle East. I was 15 years old, and my sister was 16 when my father came one day, and he decided that we should both be married in 1 week. Well, we didn't know who were the men, how old they were, and we couldn't say no to my father. We were raised sheltered. We didn't have any opinion. And we saw my mother also in the same situation. We believed at that time that this what God wanted from us is to be obedience and not to voice our desire or anything, just accept what they throw on us, our parents. But I had a sister who was 1 year older than me, and she was very courageous, and she wouldn't accept anything that were told to us in the house. She couldn't accept the fact that men had so many privileges and we couldn't. At that time, growing up, I really didn't know that she was a feminist when neither I nor her knew what the word feminist was. But she rejected everything our parents, especially my brother and my father and our cousin living with us. I followed her, And I'm going to take the culture further than you, because the culture, the roots of what's happening to the women and girls in the Middle East, I only know that recently, after we had the new president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, in Egypt. We are now listening to what really made those men treat these women this way. It's not just a simple culture, no, it's heritage. And the heritage comes from two books that the Muslim people have been worshipping and following since 1,200 years ago. And those books are called Al-Bukhari and Al-Muslim, Al-Sahih. And right now, we have people on the media dissecting those books and dissecting what those parables that they are supposed to be taken from the word of mouth and from many people that lived 200 years after the Prophet died. In those books, you will hear horror about how to treat women. And those two guys who wrote those books, they were actually not Arab. They didn't speak the language. God knows from where they came. But they put those books. And now when they are confronting Al-Azhar, the Islamic Institute in Egypt, which, you know, educates most of the theologians around the world, Muslims. Now they are taking back some of the parables in the books, and some of them so gross. And I'm just going to mention one of them, that a husband has the right to eat his the flesh of his wife. It is actually written in those books. So those books are the books that all men right now in the Middle East and Muslim men are following. They are not following the Quran. The book, the holy book, is not the one that the culture comes from. It comes from those two books. And hopefully our president right now, he demanded to have a religious revolution to remove those books, most of the parables in the books from the Al-Azhar. So I hope that this is going to happen. When I wrote the book, I really didn't believe that one day I'm going to see this happening in Egypt, attacking the core of this culture and removing it so that women can see that they have rights. Actually, I don't like to use the word women's rights, because we were all born with rights. I mean, when we were born, we had the same rights as men. I never heard a man say men's right. Have you ever heard any man say men's right? Because they give themselves this luxury that they were born with that right, but we have to fight all our lives for that right. No, we don't. No. And I blame most women in Egypt. Most women in Egypt and the Muslim world, they actually blindly follow this culture and this tradition and this hadith, and which is making it very difficult for somebody like me to penetrate the mind of these women and tell them, wake up, go. When I ask some of those people, have you ever heard, read those books? Do you know what those books are saying? They say no. And then I say, so why you are blindly believing what's in it? Why do you have to believe that you are a third, you know, you are not to be respected or to be by men in this society? But my sister, in the book, you will learn from my sister that she really fought my parents. And I didn't know how she had the courage to do that. I was the shy person, the one. And I was very scared of confronting my brother or my father, but she was the one who gets beaten because she was always saying, no, I'm not going to do this or that. She even didn't want to have the marriage. So my father used to lock her up in the pantry, and the pantry was like maybe 5 feet by 3 feet and no window, and she will sit there for 3 to 4 days locked up, just because she would not say, I'm sorry, and I will do what you want. But then she was really funny, because she said to me, Laila, listen, let's get married, because this is the only way we will get out of this hell. And she called our home the golden cage, because my father was an architect and he put us, funny enough, in a French Catholic school. And he regretted that later on, you know, when he came to visit me. He said, that's my biggest mistake. He thought that by putting us with French nuns, we will be, you know, taken care of, like he is doing to us, sheltered and not speaking when we are not told. But we learned from our friends, which they were Greeks, French, Italian. We knew that there is another world outside, that those girls, they have the freedom to do what they want. They are liberal. But we never told our father that we will go home and then we will be, you know, like all Muslim girl. We cannot do so and so and so. But finally, my sister and I, we actually got married. And I don't want to tell you a lot about the book, but we fought our parents, we fought the society, we fought the neighbors, and my father put his own fatwa on me, especially that he gave the right to my brother to take my life, but it didn't scare me. My sister and I, we did everything we could until we left. And we left innocent, inexperienced, with no money, but we didn't care because what we had in our hand, more valuable than men, is our freedom, which we never really felt before in our home. I never lived my teenager life. I don't know how it feels to be in school and having a prom and having this. I never did that. My father took this away from me, and he threw me to this marriage, to this old man. I wonder what happened to us women, you know, the dawn of civilization. Women were worshipped, and we had all the goddesses, Isis, Inanna, Ishtar, you name it. And men, they used to castrate themselves just to go in those temples to have these goddesses worship them. And then we have women like Cleopatra and Hatshepsut ruling, and the world, in this part of the world, were living in peace because these women, usually, they don't really fight. I have a lot to say. Anyway, I just want to tell you that this book of mine is a present to my sister. And I'm sure she is looking up down at me now, up, you know. And I want to tell her I made it because during the time we lived together, she used to tell me, Laila, you are so romantic and so emotional. I don't know how you will survive in this world alone. I just want to tell her I did, and I'm here, and I know she is proud of me now. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Laila. Laila is the author of, what is the name of the book? Out from the Shadow of Men. Thank you. Our next speaker is Judith Hornook.
Thank you, Dina. Dina introduced me already in a very good way. I'm honored to be here today at the famous Commonwealth Club. I just arrived from New York, where I presented at the Princeton Club about American businesses in the Arab Gulf, how to be successful in the business in the area. And I'm happy to be back here in the beautiful Bay Area. As Diana mentioned before, at my company, we focus on businesses in the Arab Gulf for many years, coaching businesses, entrepreneurs, and companies to understand how Arab business people think, what drives them, how they make decisions. We constantly researching ways to improve a successful business deal for our clients worldwide. Studying the Arab business ladies in the Gulf was always fascinating for me, all my life. How these women reached their goals. And then one day, after the accumulative effort of more than 2,000 questions, we asked ourselves and businesswomen in the Arab Gulf, discussing, brainstorming, building on each other's ideas, finally progress had been made. My team and I realized these successful Arab businesswomen use certain techniques and actions to reach their goals. We call their techniques the golden rules of quiet reformers. Rules that applies also to Western business people who want to do successful business in this part of the world, especially Americans. These golden rules are going to be part of our next book, Honegan Partners Business Book, we are working on at the moment. So it's really fascinating. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Judith. Judith is the author of The Modern Arab Woman. And thank you very much to our distinguished panel for their comments. And now it's time for the question and answer period. We have a large number of questions, so let's begin. Aisha, there were many, many questions about Afghanistan, and many of the questions are focused on the women in the Afghan government. So I'm going to basically read you a string of questions because they're all very related. Are women in Afghan government treated equally on the job? What other jobs are accepted as okay for women? Do women in the parliament in Afghanistan actually have any power, or are they figureheads or silent? When women become members of parliament in high proportions, did they create more rights for women, and has it made a difference? Many, many questions, but of course all relating to women in parliament. Yeah.
I do want to say that I think that Afghanistan in particular is very different. And I think that a lot of people, when they speak of different cultural communities, they always say, oh, this particular country is different. But I can tell you Afghanistan is different than any country in the world. Obviously, we've seen that with as many countries as invaded, they stand on their own. So it is very different. It's very hard to get along with. It's very hard to understand. And if you're, and I truly believe this, if you're not really part of the Afghan culture, you really won't understand it because they have a lot of nuances that sometimes slip, you know, a person that's trying to learn or be a part of that culture. I do want to say that Afghan culture is very different in the sense that women are actually very powerful in that community. One of the things is that historically there have been women who fought alongside of men, very similar to Iran prior to Islam. Women were leaders. We have very famous female poets, female writers, female educators, are some of the queens that we have had in the past are very, very powerful. Today, we have a couple of members in parliament that are very, very strong leaders. I think Shukriya Barakzai is a great example of that. She pushes for reform. She pushes for women's rights. She is probably one of the best examples of strong leadership in women. I do also want to say that there are a lot of figureheads. There are a lot of just symbols, just have a woman taking the seat, but very little change on their behalf. One of the reasons for this is, and I've talked to a lot of these women saying that, you know, you guys haven't done as much as I would want you to. And they clearly stated that sometimes they are influenced by their husbands. So regardless of the fact that they hold the role that's very powerful in their country, their husband influences them. Their father influences them, and their brothers influence them. So sometimes these women are forced to make a decision or vote on something that they truly do not want to vote on, but the pressure is there. So until we resolve that type of pressure, that's one thing. The other thing is that ethnically in Afghanistan, it's a very diverse country. We have a lot of different people of different ethnic backgrounds, and these tribal warfares, and the reason why they've had a civil war for as long as they've had is because the ethnic tension is very great. So, for example, the individual that I showed you, one of the photos, she specifically will stand on certain issues, as well as her sister's a member of parliament, just because the person that is presenting is of the same ethnic background, even if she does not agree with it. Where there have been people, women leaders, who have told me that when I have complained about something and these women stand amongst them, they say, don't think that I support you. I don't like you, but I'm standing because we are of the same ethnic background. This is also very, very clear signs of corruption. And I understand why they do it, but at the same time, this also limits women's progress if they aren't able to get past this type of pressure. Women in general do a lot of different types of jobs, but majority of their jobs are in the house or away from the public. Women secretly have to work. For example, Roya Mahboob, she had to be in hiding in order to develop these classrooms to teach women how to program and how to build their businesses and things like that. They get death threats. They have to be moved around significantly. And I mean, every night they spend their night asleep somewhere else, somewhere hidden in a city, in a family's home, something like that. They are not free in a lot of the other regions of Afghanistan. The only place that they can progress a lot more than the rural areas is in Kabul. But I clearly showed you that individual that was stoned to death and burned alive, she was in Kabul. She was falsely accused. And I do believe that it's only because she was a woman standing up for the rights that she saw. And the only people that stoned her were men. The sad part to me was that majority of the men that stoned her and took part in her beating and her death were young men. And that to me is a very clear sign that something needs to be done. So the fact that 4 people were hanged and 11 people are going to serve 1 year, that's not enough.
I have a follow-up question relating to that. Someone asked, what would happen to a man who's falsely accused of burning the Quran? This question is not meant to be controversial. I am curious. Perhaps this is not the best example if both men and women would be treated equally under the circumstances.
I actually think that they would be treated differently because you're only as strong as your network. And in Afghanistan, our network is our tribes. So if you come from a particular tribe that is very dominant and historically very well respected, it's very hard to say that you've committed a sin or you've, you will get stoned or anything like that. Women, for this particular case, she was not able to say, I'm from this tribe. I have my people with me. And that is another reason why she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Whereas men will be saying, okay, he's the cousin of so-and-so, or he's the grandson of so-and-so. So we have to back off. And even if we do push this to trial, let's say that he was accused, rule of law is a little bit more practice when it comes to men. Whereas for women, a man can violate another man's wife in the street and nothing is done. And this is not fair.
We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Women Seeking Success and Reform. Judith, an audience member asked if you could mention some of the things that your firm discovered about Arab businesswomen in the Gulf.
Discovered. In which way discovered?
Tell us more about Arab women, Arab businesswomen in the Gulf.
Yeah, so we discovered coming and going to the Arab Gulf over 10 years, we studied the society there. As I mentioned before, for us it was really interesting to understand how these businesswomen reached their goals to come there. The businesswomen we've met and engaged with are successful, as I mentioned before, these certain approaches and techniques, these golden rules of quiet reformers. We're working on these case studies for many years now, as, for example, the first female racing driver of the United Arab Emirates, Naila. Naila followed the golden rule number 1. It was mentioned before, the importance of family, the family tribes, the family is so important, especially in the Arab world. I'm focused on the Arab Gulf. I can speak only about the Arab Gulf. Because this society is so family-oriented, Naila took a milestone approach. She worked from inside out. That's so interesting to observe. From her own family. Started to convince the members of the family. Father, mother, brother, uncle, sister. She prepared powerful argumentation, like selling points. Yeah, it's really interesting when you listen to all these argumentations she put together. Made clear that being a female racing driver, that this will not insult the culture and the tradition of her own country. That's very, very important in this part of the world. She built trust in the family with her own family members, in her own tribe. And there's another very important step these successful Arab businesswomen said. During their meetings with their families, when they come together, they always focus on the person who had the greatest power and authority in the family. They identify the leader, the tribal leader. Again, family, tribal leader. This system is so important to understand, this most influential person in the family. And that's so interesting for us during our talks with American business people. We observed that applies exactly to American businesses as well. All Americans who are successful today in the Arab Gulf, and we have a lot of case studies, they followed golden rule number one about the importance of family. They understand the more value you put on the family, the more value for the business with them. And they understand how they build a good reputation with the knowledge and the tribal system. So these golden rules will be a part of our business book, and we will give you then a deeper insight of all these techniques, but to give you a little insight about that now.
Thank you. There is a question: in the current environment, when men are in charge, how can the women's environments be changed? How can things change? How can the situation for women change, given that the control is mainly male-dominated? Do you want to address that, Judith?
Yes, I have to address now, because I think it's really, we must be very careful with generalization. For me, generalization is a virus, and you get infected easily. I was infected. I was working before in the Formula One, did television, business people, and personalities. I never wanted to come to the Arab Gulf. Never. So, because I had a very clear picture from the media about the Arab Gulf. Later on, I came there, and I was presented with a very different picture. I have thought about. And I think, for example, when we see I see a lot of trends in the Arab Gulf, in the business side. For example, only in February, Sheikh Mohammed Rashid, the ruler of Dubai and vice president, here it is. Only this February 2015, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, vice president and ruler of Dubai, announced to form a gender balance council to empower women, a council that will ensure women are given leading roles in the development of the country. I see a lot in the United Arab Emirates. I just came back from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabian business ladies are part of the Chamber of Commerce, Women's Trade. I think we must be really careful to generalize. This I want to say. I think there are good people and bad. We focus on the good people to follow. I think as more others will follow, other will come. And I think every little small percentage makes later on a big milestone for society. And I have this belief because I saw it. That's my personal picture about it.
Thank you.
I personally want to say that I'm actually very proud of the women in Afghanistan. I think that there is no lack of ambition on the women's part. I think that, to me, they give me a lot of hope. And one of the things is that with Farhunda being stoned and the way she was buried, there was a protest of 3,000 women in the streets of the capital protesting for justice. So that clearly shows me that women are capable of standing up. The only thing that I believe that we don't really consider is the fear. Women are really afraid. And honestly, when I was there, I was afraid. You know, when you're walking around making eye contact with people and, you know, being told you're not supposed to do that, you know, you're afraid of having acid thrown in your face, being disappointed in the sense of how men treat you, in the sense that they could say whatever they want to say to you, they could physically harm you. You feel helpless. And I think that women in Afghanistan, again, there is no lack of ambition there. I think that they have a lot of ambition, that they want to succeed, that they want change. And some of the women actually told me that they plan in 10 years to run for president. And the fact that that's even in their mind, the fact that that's even a possibility is success to me. One of the women actually, she ran for vice president. And she came in close, and she's the governor of her region in central Afghanistan. Her place is the most safest, the best protected, the best in education, the best in culture. It is the safest place to be, and a woman is the governor of that place. And I'm very proud of the work that the women are doing. But I do want to also state that, for example, I always relate back to history. And one of the things that I was fascinated in reading was Aristotle once said that these people, Persian people, are savages because they allow women to sit at the same table as men and speak of politics. Now, I'm thinking, were we savages then? Or are we reverting in some other way? Because we were far more progressive long ago. And I think slowly with, you hear, you know, Kipling stating that, you know, beware of when the Afghan women come out. And I think that that is happening slowly. So I'm very proud of Afghan women and their progress, considering that they've had 40 years of war, considering that they are not allowed to go to school, considering that they are objects and completely beaten and abused. I'm very, very proud of the progress that they're making in a very short period of time of roughly 10 years or so. So I'm very proud of the progress.
Thank you. Judith, you had a comment.
I wanted to say that we also observed that the best investment is for sure education for women. This is, and I see it in the Arab Gulf very strong. For example, in my foreword, I was writing about that they call him Papa Zayed. This is the founder of the United Arab Emirates, Sheikh Zayed, Papa Zayed, Papa Zayed, and Sheikh Rashid Maktoum, father from the ruling Maktoum now. They understood that the good concept is to have both sides in a society, women and men, and they invest in that, and I think that is fantastic. Because you asked before, where's the hope? Hope is so important for us. I was always looking for hope and for the positive things. That's our focus as engagement coaches, to understand the other side. And I see a trend. I see a change in the education that women more and more coming there, and when they earn their own money, they have the independence and they can do their business. So there is hope.
I'm actually going to get a lot of heat for saying this, but I personally think that as we progress in all areas of economic support, political reform, these things, I think that particularly, I think that religious reform will do a lot of good. And I'm not saying to change anything in regards to the religion or anything like that, but I'm saying the way it's being done. Men tend to use the religion as a tool to oppress other people. The leaders in religion tend to be men. The followers, the strong followers, tend to be men. And one of the things that this lady, Farhunda, who was stoned and beaten to death, the reason she actually questioned one of the religious leaders, and he is the one who started the stoning. He is the one who said she burned the holy book, which she didn't. And after an investigation was done, when they checked the mosque, when you hear stories of women being touched when they're praying, this was 7 a.m. in the morning, and that's considered safer for women to go out. They're going to leave by sunset. The funny thing was that they found used condoms, they found a bed, they found a lot of things that make you question what was really going on in that particular mosque. It makes you question what was really happening with these men, what type of bribes they were getting, what types of beliefs they were spewing out to these uneducated people, come sleep with me and your demons will go away. They can push that. And nothing's being happened. How can we say that you as a mullah, how are you a mullah when you're one uneducated? There is no real system of being granted being a mullah. And I think a four-year degree for anybody who wants to be a mullah, which is like a holy man, a degree in psychology, some education, some counseling services in the sense that they understand that women are a very big part of the family. I think those types of reforms, those types of structures to make sure that the right people are the religious leaders. I think that's the number one thing that can help a lot of women.
Do the women who have power in Afghanistan, perhaps the parliamentarians mentioned, do they have educations outside of Afghanistan?
Yes. In fact, I actually think that a lot of the women that I met that were very sharp and very very well informed were actually raised in other countries. For example, they studied in Iran, they studied in London, they studied in Pakistan, in India, in the United States, and then they came back and they're serving their country. And I think that's the number one thing that we should push.
We have, unfortunately, just time for one last question. And we have a comment here that the audience member is very impressed with Afghan students who've come visit us here, especially their optimism and yours also. How can there be such optimism in a tribal situation? Is this optimism applicable only to Kabul, or will things go beyond? Are women winning elections everywhere?
Women are actually winning elections everywhere, and the tribal... One of the things that I want to explain in tribal circles in Afghan culture is that one of the number one rules of the code of Afghans is that you have to protect your land, you have to protect your resources, and you have to protect your women. And I think that's why security was a very big issue. But one of the stories goes, if a woman asks a man something, he cannot refuse her. If he does, he is not a man. So if she asks for a diamond ring, it might take 10 years, but the guy is supposed to deliver is kind of the mentality. So women are protected and they are supported. And some of the women I mentioned, they're in very rural areas, but men support them. Men are the ones that defend them, and men are the ones that want them to succeed. So I do think that women can succeed in Afghanistan particularly.
Laila, do you have a comment on, or Judith, sorry,
I really, no, but I really have to say, coming and going over 10 years to the Arab Gulf, I saw a lot of Arab businessmen who supported women. We must be really careful. They're horrible stories, and I respect that, and it was so interesting to listen to you, full of respect. But I see really also other picture in the business world. I just was in Saudi Arabia. There's a Saudi Arabian businessman, and he hires mostly Saudi Arabian ladies, for example. So I think we have also to be always careful for the generalization. Very careful. We must listen. We will continue with that as engagement coaches, to listen, to watch, to observe, and to help really both sides in the businesses to get a better feel. And that is only when you start to be more neutral, when you're coming to the other side and start with a new relationship and give it a try, I think, in business and in life.
Thank you. Thanks to our distinguished panelists, Aisha Wahab, Laila Sisi, and Judith Hornook, for their presentations. We also thank our audiences here, those listening to the recording, and on the internet. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.